Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, this is Kat, Communications Director of HRN, here with a preview of Episode 2 of Meat and 3. This week, we're talking pork. We'll learn the best way to make a BLT.
I don't think I've ever successfully made a BLT just because I eat the bacon before any other part.
How pitmasters and restaurateurs are helping put small-scale pig farmers back to work in Alabama.
It's all about money. That's the bottom line.
What pork has to do with economics?
Farmers could be particularly affected by China's threat to levy its own tariffs on pork and soybeans.
And with government.
Basically, all of politics is pork at this point.
So tune in on Friday afternoon for your weekly serving of Meat and Three, and make sure you subscribe to be the first to know when new episodes air.
I love the way you like blast that out there for me, Dave. It's so great. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm excited to announce that today we have an interview with the erudite Raj Patel. Raj is an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. He is a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin, and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at the university currently known as Rhodes University in South Africa. He has degrees from the University of Oxford, the London School of Economics, and Cornell University. He's worked for the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and protested against both of them. His first book was Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And his second, The Value of Nothing, was a New York Times and international bestseller. His latest book, which we're going to be talking about a bit today, was co-written with Jason W. Moore and is called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. He is currently working on a groundbreaking documentary project about the global food system with the award-winning director Steve James. Welcome to the show, Raj. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Katie.
It's truly a pleasure. I'm a long-term admirer of your work, and I've also wanted to have you on the show forever. So this is a real opportunity for me. And I think for my listeners, too, you guys are going to be running right out to buy these books, I'm promising you. So, Raj, I would love to have gushed on more and more about you. In fact, I should announce to the listeners that by Raj's instruction, I was required to cut that bio down by about two-thirds. So, I mean, really, I urge people to go to to the Raj Patel website and learn more about the many things that he has written and the many projects he's been involved in, because they really are kind of incredible and great. So what we're doing here today actually is first and foremost promoting the Slow Food Summit, because you are going to be a speaker at the Slow Food Summit. Can you talk a little bit about what that's all about?
I'm excited to be thinking about what the future of the food movement might be. Slow Food Nation is an event that'll happen later on this year in Denver, where foodies of various stripes will come and convene and figure out, really, ask some tough questions about, well, okay, what does the food movement look like in these times? What is it that we need to be fighting for? And given the sort of tenor of current political discourse in the United States, it could just be that having a mere White House garden is enough. But I think that now's a very good time to be taking stock of what it is that we really want to dream not just to have in the next year or two, but really in the next decade or two.
Yeah.
The challenges that we'll be facing in the U.S. In terms of climate change, in terms of immigration, in terms of poverty, they're not going to get any better. And now's a good time for us in the food movement to be having some very deep reflection on how it is that we're going to make sure that everyone has access to food that is good, clean and fair. Those are the three sort of pillars of slow food. Good food, meaning food that is delicious and is, you know, minimally processed and is, you know, absolutely sort of wonderful to eat. Clean, meaning that it is uncontaminated by pesticides or, you know, or sort of exotic chemistry. And fair, meaning that everyone from, you know, from land to the servers to everyone involved in the making of the food is treated with dignity, respect, and has enough money to live on so that everyone can eat. So that's the sort of tenor of the discussion we'll be having at Slow Food Nations.
Amazing. You did a really good pitch there. That was fantastic.
You're very kind.
No, it was really, that was really good. I, you know, I'm practically ready to buy my ticket right now. I should be going to this. I should be going to it. I have been in the past, but unfortunately I run an Airbnb in the summer, so I don't go anywhere.
Well, as long as you're treating your guests to food that's good, clean, and fair, I think you'll be carrying on the mission.
I do, actually. I'm very, I don't serve a lot of food, but I definitely bake. I make bread, and I make cakes, and, you know, anyway, it doesn't matter.
Brilliant.
But yes, I'm totally, I am a cook myself. I worked as a cook for many years, so.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, well, you know, it's great until your feet give out, which is essentially what, I mean, I had to stop. I just couldn't. The body, cooking is a young person's gig, I'm telling you. Anyway, so let's talk about, you have something called Now This, which appears on Facebook and I guess in other platforms. And I loved it. It's a short film. It's, what is it, about 5 minutes. And you talk about the seven cheap things that we are running out of. And it's a sort of condensation of your book about the history of seven cheap things. And so can you talk about what those seven things are and make some of the connections?
Sure. I mean, and in fact, it feels like 5 minutes, but it's only 2.5 minutes long.
Oh, no kidding.
And it's...
it is packed with information.
It's because I speak fast and we pack a lot in. it's basically, we're using a very everyday object to try and get to the bottom of how it is that the world around us organizes itself. And the object is the chicken nugget. And 3 million people have seen this video about how a chicken nugget is actually the symbol of our modern era because it relies on these seven cheap things to be able to be made. So very quickly, the number one cheap thing is cheap nature, a relationship between humans and the rest of the planet that means that we get to take chickens from the jungles of Asia and genetically engineer them so that we can toss out sort of 50% of the genetic diversity of modern chickens. Mm-hmm. And what you're left with is that the modern broiler chicken is engineered so that its breasts are so large it can barely walk.
Yeah.
And we treat, you know, nature as a sort of infinite resource and infinite trash can, which is why, you know, by 2050 there'll be more plastic in the sea than fish.
Mm.
But cheap nature is the first thing. The second is cheap work because, you know, it takes workers to turn chickens into nuggets. And as you say, workers in the food system, the bodies are disposable.
Yeah.
And the third thing is cheap care because who looks after workers' bodies after they've been chewed up by the food system? It's often communities and usually it's women's work to take care of the bodies of broken workers. One of the ways that that's made easier is the fourth thing, cheap food. Because nuggets are part of this sort of constellation of cheap food that we, certainly in the U.S. and around the world, get in order to be able to survive having low wages. Cheap energy is required to keep us warm and to be able to, you know, speed the production line. Cheap money is required so that, you know, these industries have low interest loans. And the last thing is cheap lives. You know, the people on the chicken production line are predominantly women and people of color.
Yes.
And that means that, you know, whether it's in food or globally, we're seeing a rise of forced work, and globally, you know, 40 million people are modern-day slaves. So those seven cheap things come together in this chicken nugget, and it's sort of a terrifying object, and one that we, you know, we're already going through 50 billion bones, chickens a year.
Yeah.
So there will be trillions of chicken bones laid in the fossil record as proof that we humans were here.
Yes. Consuming our feathery friends there at a great rate. It's amazing that chicken has become, in such a short time, the most popular protein around the world. Because, you know, back in the day, in the 50s and 60s, we didn't eat chicken every single day like we do now. And I guess
part of that push is the chicken industry itself.
Yeah.
Certainly some of the fears around pork and beef have you know, also fed into that. The fact that chickens are now engineered to turn into, you know, basically it's soy with feathers is how one producer described it to me.
Yeah.
You know, it only takes 90 days to be able to, and in some cases much less, to be able to turn an egg into a very profitable bit of chicken. And so all of those are reasons why it's already the most popular meat in the U.S. and soon will be the most popular meat in the world.
Yes, I think so. I mean, the Indians are ramping up their chicken production enormously, and so have the Chinese. Raj, you do know that I wrote a book about the global meat industry, right?
I do.
and so we'll be quoting extensively from that, won't we? No. Because it is all about me. I told you that. No. So I want to go back to the slavery thing for just a second, because that was news to me. That people, not only the slavery aspect, which I'm sure is, I know is happening, say, in Brazil. There's sort of, I wouldn't have called it slavery. I would have called it more indentured servitude, kind of the way we treat our migrant workers here, where, or, you know, our undocumented workers, where the passport is removed and you're trucked out to some, you know, undisclosed location where you are, you know, working until you can finally sort of pay off whatever debt you have acquired to the chicken producer. What is the scenario for slavery, and where are we using, prisoners in this country, or is that something that's happening elsewhere?
Okay, two great questions. So the first thing is, should we call this slavery in recognition of the horrors that happened in the U.S. In particular, but through the transatlantic slave trade in the U.S. and in Brazil and elsewhere? The International Labor Organization that's collected this data does call it modern-day slavery, and the key criterion is not whether you're indentured or not, but whether there is a real or perceived threat of violence if you don't do the work. And if there is coercion to make you do the work. And that coercion with the threat of violence is what it is that separates, just having to work off debt, like, you know, paying off a student loan, from being in a condition that 40 million people are, and 71% of them are women, where these workers will absolutely face violence, the threat of assault or worse, as a result of their refusing to do the work. So, if the germane thing about slavery is the captivity and the threat of violence, then most people who are in modern day slavery qualify.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to prison workers, absolutely, prison workers are part of the food system in the United States, and they are paid 25 cents an hour for their work in some parts of the chicken industry. But there's a new twist that's also a very old twist on this story, and it's when chicken executives recognized that, you know, in order to really speed and make profitable a chicken factory, it helps to have a night shift.
Yes.
Unfortunately, workers are paid very little already, and it's already unpleasant work, and there weren't many takers for the night shift. And so some workers, and this was exposed last year in a brilliant bit of investigative reporting, but some workers come from a specific place called, it's a Christian treatment center for opioid addicts. What's happened is that in order to avoid filling the prisons with people who are going through the opioid crisis, there are Christian rehabilitation centers that have been set up by chicken executives. And so the idea is that people are sent to these centers for a prolonged period of time so that they can pray during the day and work during the night for free on chicken production lines. And then are subject to none of the standard sort of employment constraints that workers elsewhere are. And then through this mixture of prayer and labor, they will be allowed to rejoin society at the end of their term.
Wow.
And so these treatment centers are both very new and very old. I mean, it was the original technique of the Spanish colonists when they came to the New World to be able to take indigenous people and force them both to learn the word of Christ during the evenings and on Sundays, and the rest of the week work them to death, literally, in order for them to be cheap labor for the Spanish colonists. And so the chicken industry is absolutely ground zero for both some really rebarbative modern day practices that are both modern and medieval.
Wow, Raj, my jaw is still on the floor, man. If I didn't have to talk, it would still be clattering there. That is quite a story. And despite my meaty, explorations of the industry, that's a wrinkle I had not heard before. And the Christian aspect of it just makes it so perfect for me because I'm, you know, just not a fan. But are all the major chicken companies in the United States engaging in this kind of labor, or is it one particular company?
I'm not sure of the name of the processing plant, but there's a link up on my website at rajpatel.org.
Oh, I'm going to be looking for that.
The bit of journalism, and there's a great deal more horrific reporting there. So if people are interested, rajpatel.org is the place to look.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. We are all going to be looking there. There'll be a quiz, folks. let's talk a little bit more about meat companies, my favorite subject, because as many of my listeners know, consolidation in the meat industry, no matter which aspect, you know, pork, poultry, or cattle, has been played a big role in sort of dismantling rural communities, among other things, as well as breaking down competition and becoming monopolistic. So can we talk a little bit about how globalization and neoliberalism have contributed to the monopolization of agricultural industries in general? And then your most recent book, obviously, A History of the World and Cheap Things, goes even further than Reagan and Thatcher, my favorite villains of the piece, and and actually puts the onus on the one and only René Descartes, an 18th century philosopher, right? Is it 18th century? Is that right?
17th, I believe.
17th.
Sorry. Well, I mean, he was born in 1596.
Thank you. Okay.
So, he did his work in the 1600s, so yeah. 17th century.
Yep.
When it comes to thinking about the sort of spread of these of the ideas of neoliberalism, it's important to understand what that means specifically for food workers.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism is a drive to make work, in particular, cheap, that means busting unions. And when you bust unions, you remove one of the forces that stands against consolidation in a range of industries, and you make it cheap for businesses to be able to employ and fire workers at will.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of these businesses being able to consolidate, being able to get cheap labor, they grow and grow and grow. And at some point, there comes a crisis when interest rates have to go up, and then the businesses consolidate. And consolidation is the enemy of decent, well-paid work. We know yeah. that when you have the rise of monopolies, you see these sort of downward pressure on workers' wages, and workers' bargaining power is much lower when you have just one potential boss as opposed to hundreds, right? So that history is both, again, new and old. And one of the ideas that we talk about in the history of the world in Seven Cheap Things are the sort of dynamics of how it is that companies exercise their ability to be able to conquer new fields and then consolidate and control resources and pipelines and frontiers. In that story, René Descartes features because he's one of the sort of principal authors of the idea that the important civilizational boundary in our world is between humans and nature, between society and nature in particular.
Right.
And so what Descartes and his colleagues in the Enlightenment point us towards is a sort of understanding where humans are sort of exempt from the rest of nature, are different from the rest of the web of life to the extent that we can organize it as we see fit.
Yeah, and control.
And that's the idea that we're pushing here in this history of the world in Seven Cheap Things, is that if you really want to get to a sort of core idea that shapes our understanding of the world, it's that there's this division between nature and society.
Yeah. Right. And that division has basically says that man can control nature as you just said, as he sees fit. And so the end result of that is the exploitation of nature, of the seven cheap things, right?
That's right.
I mean,
yeah.
That really is, that's the connection. So when you would talk about how these ideas have gone, have mushroomed into sort of the disaster that they are now. You know, we can identify that because man and nature are separated from themselves, then we have now basically separated ourselves from the health of the planet as well as from the well-being of mankind. So what do you see as a way to repair that broken relationship and restore man to nature?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, Katie. I mean, but before I get to how it is that we might repair this, I mean, I think it's worth pointing to sort of dodgy solutions. I mean, sometimes we think of all we need is the right sort of technological fix. We need someone like Elon Musk to pull us out of the state we're in and bring us into a new world where technology makes things much, much better. And in fact, we use some of our arguments to suggest that the historical figure who is most like Elon Musk is Christopher Columbus.
Huh.
Because we might think of Elon Musk as a daring innovator who's been able to persuade bankers to give him a great deal of money, despite not a huge amount of success in his car venture. His great vision is to be able to turn this money into a wonderful new life through the magic of colonialism. And in fact, Musk is very clear that he wants to colonize Mars, and he uses that language without any shred of embarrassment. And that's very similar to the kind of guy Christopher Columbus was. Christopher Columbus persuaded bankers to bankroll his project.
Yes.
Colonize this new world, and he's colonizing the new world not for the benefit of the new world. And when he gets to the new world, one of Christopher Columbus's first laments is when he writes back to his patrons Ferdinand and Isabella. He writes, "Oh yeah, I see these wonderful plants and animals, and it causes me great sorrow that I do not know how much they're worth." He's sad because he's looking at the new world and he can't understand. He doesn't see dollar signs immediately.
Right, right. He can't figure out how to exploit it.
But he also treats his workers very badly. Christopher Columbus was responsible for enslaving Native Americans and bringing them back to Spain, and for treating his workers very badly on the ships.
Yes.
And Elon Musk kind of does that too. I mean, there have been some complaints via the National Labor Relations Board for the Tesla factory. And if you look inside a Tesla, the rare earth metals that are there have been obtained to some extent by the work of exploited workers in modern day slavery in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So, we have that layer cake of exploitation that's both very old and very new, and I'm not sure that we should trust people like Elon Musk to be able to get us out of this mess.
Well, I have to say, it never occurred to me to trust Elon Musk.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
I mean, because I'm basically a Luddite, I see ventures like Elon Musk's, voyage to Mars or even his electric car with complete suspicion. I don't see it as something that benefits all of mankind in the way that he seems to think that we should think. But anyway, I want to go back to the idea of this sort of history of exploitation, that you're describing, all the way from Columbus up to Elon Musk. I find that just so telling, and I'm just kind of curious, like where would we go? I mean, we don't have a society that actually votes in its own best interests, that seems to have a clear grasp on any sense of the future and what we need to do to leave a planet that's still habitable. I mean, all of those things seem to be eluding many of our populace, and certainly all of our leaders, as far as I can tell, with just a few exceptions. So I'm not sure, I don't ever see technology as the fix, but do you see agroecology, this growing movement of agroecology, as the thing that will save the food system, for example? I mean, how do you see digging out from under these very major layers of societal and civilizational, constructs that we've been living with now for centuries?
I think you're right, Katie, that at some level, a reckoning of where we're heading right now leads us to pessimism. I mean, certainly elected leaders are in the thrall of the people who pay for them. And you know, as we know, in the U.S., we do have the best democracy that money can buy. And so that's a reason for a great deal of pessimism. On the other hand, it would be wrong of me to have spent so much time with so many incredible social movements and to betray the hope that they live every day. And so let me tell you a little bit about the film project that I'm working on with Steve James, the magnificent American director who gave us Hoop Dreams. We've been filming for the past 6 years in Malawi with an organization called the Soils, Food, and Healthy Communities Project. Through this project, we've seen amazing transformations that are not just about agroecology. Agroecology, I'm sure your listeners are aware, is a way of farming with the earth and with natural systems. So rather than destroying unwanted pests using chemistry and then having to fill in for the wanted pests that you've just annihilated, you figure out ways of balancing the sort of cycles of pests with beneficial insects and with different kinds of crops that you sacrifice to maintain a healthy insect population while still having the food that you want to be able to eat. But all of that is for naught if you don't have a vibrant social system underneath it and around it. Without a sort of transformation of the food system, agroecology is just another technology. So you need social change. And what does that social change look like? Well, in Malawi, what it looks like is gender equality. It means men doing the cooking and looking after the kids and recognizing our patriarchy. And that's not an easy thing for men to do. I know from hard experience that that's something I'll be working on for the rest of my life. But that's a good thing, right? I mean, no one wants men to be more sexist and more patriarchal. everyone wants us to be less of that and to work so that the next generation doesn't have any of that. It's a lifetime struggle, but they're working on it in Malawi, and I think that's a great source of hope because they're figuring out in that process not just issues around radical gender equality, but also how to fight climate change and how to have a sovereign local economy and how to have better health care and how to have a decent sort of banking system even. Yeah. And that seems to me a tremendously important thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And then you may say, well, all right, fine, that's great in Malawi. What about us in America? Well, in the end, our friends from Malawi said, well, we're working on all of this, but we hear that Americans don't care about climate change. Can we come to America and talk to people who are skeptical about climate change, whether it's farmers in the heartland or, the White House or wherever it is that we need to go? We want to go and persuade Americans. And we've managed to film some of that. And if we can finish raising the funds, we'll have that out in the theaters next January.
Oh, how fantastic. Excuse me, Raj, let's take a quick break and do a sponsor drop, and then we'll come back. I want to talk more about this. Sort of U.S. versus the rest of the world.
Brilliant.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. On the line with me today is Raj Patel, the author, academic, and activist. I like that AAA rating you got there, man. So we were just talking about your project in Malawi, and it made me, you know, think. I mean, when I hear about projects like that, and when I see, you know, the way developing countries have rejected a lot of the sort of World Bank funded technology for, you know, using genetically modified seeds, or, you know, the yellow, what was it, the golden rice that was supposed to be like the lifesaver for, and, you know, so many of these crops have not really worked out the way they were supposed to. And I feel like these developing countries are going to be the leaders, because Americans just don't want to know what is actually happening. I mean, I feel like there's kind of a deliberate effort to, I don't know whether it's because our education system is failing or whether it's the fault of the media, but Americans so often, as I said before, vote in against their own best interests. And that the same is so true of the farming community in so many ways. And I think that that's, you know, this is where I feel like we really need to figure out how to change those hearts and minds to get to that society and say, you know, hey, this technology that you've been working with for the last 40, 50 years that is so chemical dependent is not the way forward. It's having too much damage. And it's really fascinating to me how hard it is to turn that boat. What do you think would help the most in terms of having, I think farmers, sorry to go on and on like this, I apologize.
No, you're making a very valid point.
I think that a lot of farmers, I'd say probably most of them at this point, recognize that climate change is real and that it's not going to go away. So, but I don't see an embrace, the kind of wholehearted embrace of new technologies that I would hope would be really percolating through the system at this point. So where do you think that that disconnect is coming for the farming community in general?
First, I mean, I think you're right that there are people around the world in the global south who are fed up with the kinds of economic prescriptions that we are making their governments take.
Yeah.
But it's not clear to me that the governments are necessarily doing right by their citizens. I mean, I think it's perfectly possible for the Malawian government to sell out their poorest citizens, just as it's possible for the U.S. government to be doing that, and both governments are doing a great job of not tending to the needs of the poorest citizens, or, you know, just regular average working citizens, but in general catering to the needs of the richest.
Yes.
So I think the Malawi story is actually much more hopeful and applicable to the U.S. because while the government goes about its business and is, you know, very much trying to join the neoliberal club, some citizens are saying, look, we've had enough. And that is something that we definitely got a sense of when we were in the U.S. But in the farming community, we met a lot of people who are skeptical, not about climate change, but about, in particular, the Democrat response to climate change, which was very mealy-mouthed at best. You know, if joining the Paris Treaty is as good as it gets in terms of climate change, and you can understand why certain people are skeptical about it, because whether you're on the left or the right, it's not enough, and it's also just too onerous. And there are much more, and in fact, I want to quote Jim Goodman of the Family Farm Defenders here. Jim is a hero of mine, and he points out that actually, you know, in the last election, the Bernie supporters and the Trump supporters had a lot in common.
Yes.
Because they understood that, you know, that actually elites weren't looking out for them. And what it came down to was, do you choose someone who's going to be, you know, looking out for the elites in one way, or who promises not to look out for the elites but does it anyway? I think that the kind of bottom-up organizing that we need for this kind of transformation is happening. It's just not happening from our mainstream political parties. And, you know, that's fair enough. So we shouldn't expect our mainstream political parties to be doing the hard work of imagining a future. That's not what political parties are for. I think, you know, anyone who believes that salvation is going to come from either the Democratic or the Republican Party is sorely mistaken. That's not what parties do. And you know, in general, when you look at the history of civilization, it's about, you know, and when you look at the sort of big changes, it comes from organizing, not from these sort of temporary and transient things called political parties. So I am actually optimistic with the kinds of organizing that come from Family Farm Defenders, for example, or, you know, the National Family Farm Coalition. There are folk who are embracing really deeper visions of how it is that, you know, we need to respond to climate change. And some of the footage we got in our film between Malawian activists and American activists and just American farmers who are skeptical about democratic approaches to climate change, I think we're very, very revealing.
Huh. Well, I don't know how to part. I don't know how to absorb that, actually.
Well, I mean, do you agree that let's start with the last point of agreement, where the Bernie and the Trump supporters had a lot in common. Does that sound like it's a path that you could find some optimism down?
Yes and no. I mean, no, because Trump was so palpably a con man from the get-go that, you know, I was just blown away by the number of people who were hoodwinked and then who were also roped into the whole sort of, you know, ethnic, racial profile, you know, the whole identity politics thing. I mean, all of that, it just, you know, the dog whistling for every worst aspect of humanity being brought to the fore. And I think that's playing out in our society right now. I mean, with all these arrests of, you know, people of color as they, you know, enter their place of living or, you know, like that was right in my neighborhood in New York. Just so you know, like that guy who had worked at the Obama administration who was moving into his apartment on 106th Street. I live on 107th Street. You know, like that's my home turf. Like it was unimaginable to me that something like that could happen. I've lived in that neighborhood for 40 years. Like just not, anyway, I digress. But I'm going to go on just because I want to talk a little bit about revolution, because what you're sort of proposing here is that there is a little bit of a grassroots kind of revolution. I don't know. I have so many thoughts, Raj. I'm just like freaking out here. Sorry. But I also wanted to address something that you said a minute ago about political parties not being in the business of sort of dreaming of a future. And I mean, I don't know what their purpose is if that's not what it is. Like, they're, you know, the whole point is to have like a vision that you work towards, and that's what you sell the American people when it comes time to go to the voting booth. You know, it's like, is your vision of America to go forward in this direction, neoliberalism or globalism, or is it to go in this direction, which is protectionism and isolationism? I mean, like, those are the two futures that were presented to us, essentially, right? And well, I think that's what political parties are supposed to do. I don't think that they're not supposed to do that. I mean,
One of the things that we in this history of the world in Seven Cheap Things, one of the things that we did was sort of look at the origins of modern liberal democracy, and you know, we point out that in general the modern liberal, and you know, this isn't liberal in terms of Democrat and Republican liberal, but just liberal in terms of you know, modern capitalist subject liberal. And the modern sort of liberal human was basically a white man, and that's important to bear in mind that democracy has rarely, its original kind of vision was not to be for everyone. It was for a certain property-owning class, and then expanded to other working-class men when that was politically expedient, and then sometimes to women, and then sometimes to people of color.
Right.
But this process has been a begrudging one, where the underlying fundamental sort of goals and terms on which participation is allowed is never about the transformation of society so much as the general inclusion of the rest of the planet more or less in an adventure set up for rich white dudes with slaves. That's important to bear in mind, because if you keep harking, if people keep harking back, for example, to a constitution written by those people, then we end up not very far from the orbit of that original vision, and that's what's I think important to remember just about the democratic political process is that the last stage of democracy is voting. That's the most boring bit of democracy. The rest of democracy is people taking charge of their lives and of the, you know, of how it is that the economy is organized, how resources are shared, how everyone contributes or doesn't to working, who looks after the kids, who looks after the elders. Those kinds of questions are things that every society has at some level wrestled with. And insofar as our capitalist society manages to dodge most of these questions and, you know, throw the work of care onto the shoulders of women, to throw the work of, you know, of sort of labor either onto the work of, you know, onto the shoulders of American workers, or when they become too expensive, onto the shoulders of other workers or undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. That's an indictment of what the democratic process is here. And so that's why I think, you know, political parties are not the sort of visioners of change. Mm-hmm. People are the visioners of change, and we must tell the parties what to do rather than the other way around.
Oh yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. Because it's hard for me to imagine, I'm so trained to think about democracy in the way that you have just told me I should not be thinking, and you're right. you know, I'm struggling to find a vision elsewhere. Like, where else in the world do we have sort of more? I mean, as I put in the outline, I interviewed Eric, your friend Eric Holt Jimenez, about his book A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, which I thought was fantastic, and mm-hmm. he is essentially arguing for revolution, and he made many of the points I think that you've just made, and but I never really got the sense of what should we be striving for in terms of a vision that is inclusive and that provides for everyone? Because none of the ones that, I mean, communism didn't really work, did it?
That's right.
Socialism seems to work pretty well, but that's always in a smaller country with, I don't know, it seems to work well for the Scandinavians and not really so well for other people, I guess.
But again, the U.S. does have a democratic socialist history. I mean, the bumper sticker, of course, is that the last time America had a democratic socialist president, it worked so well that they had to impose term limits in order that he didn't win again.
Yeah.
The sort of history of American of the United States, even though, you know, people have gone out of their way to suppress it, is a very radical history. This is a very radical country. I mean, the whole idea of America is a very radical idea. I think that's something worth remembering, particularly now when it seems like, times are dark, that actually this is a country that does have, certainly an ignoble history that has a reckoning in terms of genocide and in terms of, mm-hmm. colonization when it comes to First Nations. But it's also a country that has had a history of engaging with ideas around socialism and anarchism. I mean, if you want to know how women got the vote in the United States, it was because of organizing in socialist and anarchist clubs in across the United States.
Absolutely.
If you want to look at how we got the Glass-Steagall Act, it was because Americans demanded the nationalization of all banks, and Congress sold out the American people with a compromise that sort of served well enough until the Clinton administration dismantled it. Mm-hmm. So this is a country that has understood the possibilities of organizing and controlling government and being the government in a way that is very different from the kinds of politics that we think of now. I mean, I was lucky enough to have a conversation with Jim Hightower.
Really?
The day before yesterday. And he, he put it very well, that the goal is not for us to elect the government we want, it's for us to become the government. And that's both, again, a very old and a very new dream for America to be having. And I think insofar as we're looking for hope, we can find it in the huge number of people who are right now ready to become the government. I mean, I was talking to him about living here in Texas in a red state. He reminded me, well, we're not a red state, we're a non-voting state. What we need to do is remind ourselves that, yes, there is a long history of American racism and bigotry, but there's also a great tradition of American hope and transformation. And the more that we can recruit people to that, the more that we can remind America that there is both a history to atone for, but a history to hope for as well.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful conclusion, actually. Maybe we should wrap this up. I was thinking as you were talking, about all of the young people who are now engaged because of the horrendous school shootings, and that how many of those kids are becoming politically active, and that really is the hope that we will see them pursue programs that will benefit everyone. Because the thing that I come back to again and again is that, you know, at least 30% of the people in this country routinely vote against their own best interests. They don't want universal health care. They don't want unions. For whatever reason, they think that they don't want these things or that they're bad and they really want to follow that capitalist dream like all the way into the grave. Mm-hmm. And it's really going to take a completely new thought process, which I hope the kids will bring to the table because, I mean, us old people have really failed. I don't include you, but I'm old. I'm old and I failed, even though I've been quite political all of my life. One thing I want to talk about just before we go is the farm bill was rejected by the House. What was that about? Well, what do you think happened there?
I mean, it was largely, it appears, a rebellion around immigration.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I mean, when we're looking at histories of race in America, those ideas are alive and well. And I wouldn't venture to say that you failed. I think that we're always fighting a fight that is never guaranteed. We live in a time of politics without guarantees. Yeah. To use the words of the great British philosopher Stuart Hall. But it's okay to live in a time without guarantees. If we were guaranteed success and victory all the time, we wouldn't be creatures of free will.
Right.
The possibility of losing is always around the corner. But that's why we have to keep fighting, and that's why, even though it seems like the times are dark right now, there's no guarantee that they're going to be better, but there's no guarantee that our efforts won't succeed. So, we'll never win always, and it would
right.
be foolish to imagine that we would. But I think, we can take courage, as you are, from the resurgence of young people taking, getting very political and moving that politics, hopefully, not just to a world where there are no more school shootings, but where we can live in a very different kind of relationship to one another and to the planet.
Yes.
And that's something to hope for.
It is something to hope for. Well, on that note, I guess we have to say goodbye. But Raj, I hope you will come back. This has been one of my favorite conversations in 10 years of doing this show. So thank you
so much,
thank
Katie.
You very
I'm
much.
Looking forward to our next chat. To talk to one
Excellent. Another. We'll do it soon. And thanks to my sponsor, Wisconsin Cheese. And thanks, of course, to my beloved engineer, Dave Tatasciore. Got it right, Dave. Thanks for listening, folks. I'll see you next week. Take care now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.